from 1981. It's from an album called The Fire of Unknown Origin, Blue Oyster Cult, and it's a veteran of the Psychic Wars, which I feel like sometimes myself. Welcome back to Not the BCFM's Politics Show with author of 9/11 Revealed Ian Henshaw and Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers, and me, Tony Gosling. This week, Charlie Hebdo terror trials are happening this week. Why has it taken 5 years for the French establishment to get their story straight and bring those arrested into court? And as Russian dissident Alexei Navalny lies sick in a Berlin hospital, apparently poisoned with Novichok, what is US spy Vil Sultanovich Mirzyanov's role in the decades-long Novichok story? Is it actually as dangerous, Novichok, as we've been told? And what about Alexander Litvinenko, who's also supposed to have been poisoned by Putin back in 2006? Only his brother, sister and father don't think he was. And the British inquest only said he probably was. Did he ever really work as a spy? Or was Litvinenko just a former policeman trying to sell protection to gullible Western visitors to a newly opened up Russia? And more to the point, trying to blackmail criminal oligarchs in London, which could have gotten him killed. Also, next week, it's the anniversary of the 2001 9/11 attacks, with the official story in pieces and evidence pointing to the Israeli Secret Service, in conjunction with traitors within the United States government and military actually being behind these attacks. We get the views of former psychological warfare officer Scott Bennett, airline pilot and author of The Big Bamboozle, Philip Marshall, producer of the In Plain Sight video, Dave von Kleist, and we hear the testimony of National Security Advisor on the day, Richard Clarke, all under the expert eye of author of 9/11, The New Evidence, who's joined us here in the studio. And finally, a medieval satanic group infiltrating monotheistic faiths, hell-bent on privatising the earth so they could buy it up for their own private property. An English king that stood in their way and had his head removed for his trouble. The author of The Dying God we heard from last week, giving his view on the origins of the fake Jewish Kabbalah, one of the world's best scholars and authors on the topic, the author of Transhumanism, The History of a Dangerous Idea as well, his name David Livingstone. So this week on the Rosicrucians and the role of Francis Bacon and John Dee in paving the way for a militant atheist establishment behind the British Empire that built the New World Order of today. That's our final item tonight. But we start, I think, with Charlie Hebdo. Just on the basic point, Martin, why is it that 5 years after, it's taken 5 years for this to actually come to court? What on earth is going on?
Well, I have to say, I don't quite know what's going on in particular in relation to this court case. But we do know that most of this kind of terrorist activity has links back to Western security forces. And the Kouachi brothers, who were named as the main culprits, they looked to me as if they were patsies, and they took their passports with them on the operation, etc. The usual stuff where there's various clues are left to make people assume that what they know what happened.
But I mean, I'm trying to make the point here, really, that this is very suspicious. That why is the establishment taking such a long time to put these people on trial if it's such an open and shut case? And as we're told by the press, who's done it, that should be over within a year.
There's a general sort of rule with all these cases. I'm thinking going back to 9/11 as well. The things that they have the most difficulty making stand up slow it all down. So the collapse of World Trade 7, for instance, which is the most difficult thing for them to explain in 9/11, took them about 10 years before they came out with a technical report, which was full of riddles, but that's another issue. So yeah, if something takes a long time, somebody spoke to Ken Livingstone about 9/11, and he said, he laughed, and he said, well, if you're right, it'll be 150 years before they tell us the truth about it. And I think that's it, isn't it? That if they have to go slowly. When it's always more difficult creating something which isn't true than reporting on something that is true.
One thing I'm going to be very, very fascinated to see if they come up with anything about this at the trials. Finally, Commissioner Helric Fredu, he's the forgotten policeman in this. He was part of the official investigation. Yeah. His passing whilst participating in the Charlie Hebdo investigation has barely been acknowledged. His death in Limoges, southwest France, is shrouded in mystery. He allegedly committed suicide within hours of a police debriefing in the preparation of his police report. His funeral was held privately. The official story is he was depressed and had suffered from a burnout following a meeting with relatives of one of the victims. No details as to who these relatives were, where they were living. The reports fail to mention that the Kouachi brothers had spent their high school years in the Limoges region, and that the Commissionaire Ferru's police investigation was in all probability related to gathering information within the region on the Kouachi brothers, or Kouali brothers, including their whereabouts. An autopsy was performed, but he died. He was very much involved in the investigation, and suddenly Martin is dead.
Yes, I mean, I haven't prepared to discuss Charlie Hebdo, so, and of course, because it happened so long ago, relatively speaking, my memory is not as good as it might be. But I mean, the patterns are fairly clear. Lots of things, like having suicide bombers, for example, means that there is never any trial anyway. Mm. So you don't even bother to have a trial. We all know who did this. And as Tony Blair said after 7/7, having an inquiry would be a ludicrous diversion. We all know who did it. It's these guys here. And, of course, since they're all dead, there's no reason for us to have any further investigation.
OK, so today we're hearing from Pakistan. Thousands are protesting over there over the reprinting of these anti-Mohammed cartoons in France. So it's almost as if, because the trial's taking place, the newspapers are now reprinting and circulating the cartoons. That cause
it's the anti-Islam lobby, isn't it? You know, that it's all fairly predictable, really, I suppose.
Yeah, but it's, I mean, if those cartoons had been ridiculing Judaism, we'd be hearing accusations of anti-Semitism, wouldn't
yeah,
we?
Yeah, crikey, my goodness.
So why is it okay to ridicule Islam and not Judaism, then?
Well, exactly.
Well, there is no reason. I mean, either everybody can say everything, or people have got to show some respect, one or t'other.
Yeah.
Do you think these sorts of terror trials, do they usually end up with any sort of fair verdict? What can we expect, do you think, from the French?
They usually plead guilty, don't they? The standard pattern is the defence lawyer goes in, explains to them if they want to not get executed, in America at least, then they best agree with the story that the prosecutors have come up with. I mean, I'm not saying it's always not true, but, you know, it's that's the problem in America particularly. You've got this plea bargaining, and once you're accused of a, you know, capital offence, you've got the most massive interest. You've got to be a very brave person to keep up the denial. Much easier to just plead guilty. And
well, officially, three police officers were killed and honoured by President Hollande at a state funeral, and this all happened back in January 2015. I just think it's extraordinary that it takes so long for justice to the wheels of justice to start moving. And that, to me, is a red rag to a bull, or a red flag, certainly, in this case, that there's something dodgy going on here. We shall see. Anyway, the other big story of the week, Martin, has been about this guy, Alexei Navalny. You've been, again, I think, I'm popping up on RT, talking about this. So who is this Alexei Navalny in the first place, before we talk about him suddenly being taken ill on a plane and being flown to Germany?
Well, he's a political figure, fairly well known in Russia itself. He's always been opposed to the current government. He's quite associated with the Yabloko, which was a very pro-neoliberal party, which has got very minimal support these days in Russia. So opinion polls give him between 1% and 2% support. So he is a political figure, but he's not nearly as important as somebody like Nigel Farage, for example, in this country. But of course, he's presented in the West as this knight in shining armour, exposing Putin's corruption, etc., etc. But of course, there are other political forces which are much more significant, like the Communist Party and the Liberal Democrat Party in the Russia, which are far more significant in terms of opposing Putin than Navalny. So, but of course, Navalny and his acolytes are funded directly and indirectly by the National Endowment for Democracy, which is basically US taxpayers, pay them to do the sort of thing we're doing here for nothing. And they go around trying to change things from their own point of view and not getting very far.
So what is he? I mean, we keep hearing about him being an important political figure over there. But, I mean, you could also look at it as well. He's basically past his sell-by date. He's not really got much of a political traction in Russia. And it might be that he's more useful doing something else if he's... How close do we know how close he is to the Western intelligence services?
Oh, he's pretty close. I mean, you can presume... I mean, one of the things I was pointing out about this is because he's known as an anti-corruption campaigner. So he goes around and he doesn't just attack the government. He attacks, you know, local officials who are on the take and so on. That's how he's tries to gain traction. So some of them might have some motive for doing him some ill. Also, of course, his entourage will be massively infiltrated by Western intelligence, and if they wanted to do him some ill, they could. And then you say, well, the Western intelligence wouldn't do something like that. I would say, well, what happened with Boris Berezovsky in 2013 in this country, where he was basically thinking of going back to Russia, and he'd written a letter to Putin because he fell out with Putin very badly, and of course he then funded lots of Russian political movements in Ukraine and elsewhere, and basically his security detail disappeared for the afternoon, and when they came back from shopping, he'd hung himself in the bathroom.
And they never made a song and dance about it.
No, they didn't make any song and dance about it at all. But the coroner...
It was the Israelis doing his security, by the way.
Well, I don't know who was doing his security.
Former IDF people.
Was it? I didn't know that. But anyway, that's interesting. But the point is that, yes, they didn't make... You'd have thought this guy, who's... the coroner refused to sign it up. The British state said, no, he committed suicide. But his daughter wasn't happy with that, and she brought in experts on things like hanging from Germany to testify in the coroner's court. And the coroner, to his credit, refused to write it off as suicide. He said, I'm going to give an open verdict here, because it's quite possible there has been some
foul
play.
But what's the relationship between Navalny and Berezovsky?
The point I'm trying to make is that it's quite possible for the Western powers to kill people who are supposedly their allies as part of a political manoeuvre. I know it's hard for people to get their head round, but basically, they're expendable. Somebody like Navalny is never going to replace Putin. He's got no chance of doing that whatsoever. But by poisoning him, you can create an incident. And, of course, this incident has been created now. The Bundeswehr's laboratories have said it was Novichok. We'll come back to discuss what Novichok is in a minute. And now Angela Merkel is coming under pressure from the Greens and people in her own party to cancel the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, which is just about to come on stream, bringing gas directly from Siberia into North Germany. And the Americans have been trying to close this down for several months.
What is the Nord Stream 2? What economic and what political implications are there to it?
Well, Nord Stream 2 was started after the business in the Ukraine, which of course was started with a massacre in the Maidan Square, which a court in Kiev has now definitively said was not carried out by the police, but was carried out by a probably NATO-organised death squad.
They killed that doesn't sound very definitive, a probably NATO...
No, well the people who did it testified. It was Shakashvili who brought 50 snipers in from Georgia, and they testified in the court on a video link that they were the ones who'd shot the protesters. Those protesters were pro-EU. The NATO intelligence services were quite happy to kill them. Boris Berezovsky is one of Putin's major opponents. It looks as if the British were quite happy to kill him, because the family of Berezovsky are convinced that he was murdered, but they don't blame the Russians, they blame the British. And, of course, we were talking earlier about Brigadier Gordon Kerr and the Loyalist terror campaign in Northern Ireland.
Well, the thing with Berezovsky is wrong. You've just said that. But the thing with the British is that they didn't necessarily want Berezovsky blabbing around London about everything about all this kind of underworld activity between Russia and Britain.
Well, it may well be that both Berezovsky and Skripal were thinking of going back to Russia, and because they'd been embedded with MI6 for quite a long time, they'd have lots of things to talk to the FSB about. So there's your motive.
Okay, on Novichok, this substance, it didn't kill the Skripals, which is amazing, really, if it's a potent nerve agent. There's also those other people in Salisbury who did die, apparently, due to Novichok, were handling the perfume bottle. Apparently, it was all over their hands, and yet it didn't kill them. There was police messages about the dangers of fentanyl just a few days before this sort of second thing happened with the perfume bottle and these other people. Now we've got Alexei Navalny apparently being poisoned with Novichok and not dying. How potent is this stuff, Martin?
Well, it doesn't seem to be very potent at all.
Nerve agents are pretty dangerous.
Well, I mean, also the Skripal's house was demolished because it was apparently contaminated with it, even though it had just been sprayed on a doorknob. But there you go. I mean, the illogicalities of the story just scream out at anybody who's you know, got a logical frame of mind. Well, it just doesn't add up. I mean, there are plenty of, before we come to explanations of what really did happen, we can be pretty certain what didn't happen. Yeah. And in any case, if Novichok had failed to kill Skripal, why would the evil FSB try to use the same useless Novichok again and fail again?
Okay, let me just say, give you my little, I think is a little bit of inside information about Novichok. These Novichoks are real compounds. They were studied in the USSR at a bench scale in the 1970s, at a time when several countries were studying possible new nerve agents. The story of a secret program in the late 1980s and 90s to develop a chemical superweapon called Novichok was fabricated by Soviet counterintelligence to successfully flush Vil Sultanovich Mezhenov out as a US spy and a leaker, and continued after the collapse of USSR to confuse the United States. So this is an interesting angle on all of this, Martin, is that this Novichok could have been a chemical compound given to this guy, Mezhenov, in order to see if he would pass it to the West. And he did, because the Russians had their spies in the West that saw all this stuff appearing to the Western intelligence. So they realized they must have got it from him. He was not long after that. I mean, it was basically an authentic-looking secret material, which he was deliberately given access to test his loyalty. And it did indeed find its way to the United States. He was then arrested in 1992, but the trial collapsed under Yeltsin, and Mezhenov moved to the United States in 1995. The US studied the toxicity of these compounds around 1996, and all indications were they're not as toxic anywhere near as toxic as sarin or VX, the much better known nerve agents invented, I think, by the Nazis, in fact, which are apparently gotten rid of. But these are the really dangerous nerve agents. The structures of Novichoks have been publicly available since 2008, so anyone with a reasonable lab can make them at bench scale. So that I'm trying to do here is to suggest that this is, I think, the real story of Novichok. It's a type of nerve agent which was used. It wasn't very potent, so they knew it was. There was no worries about giving all this information to the West, but it was used to flush out a spy, and they did it like that successfully.
That sounds very interesting. And of course, the main thing from the theatre point of view is that Novichok sounds a very evil sort of Russian sort of nerve agent, doesn't it?
Made in Russia.
Yes, of course. And of course, this is why Novichok, if they'd said he'd been poisoned, like the Germans had said yesterday, he'd been poisoned, that would still have some credibility, because he might have been poisoned by one of his political opponents in Russia, not by the government.
And isn't it likely to have been one of his entourage?
His entourage are the people who are closest to him, aren't they? The point is that they've got to call it Novichok. Now, Novichok, as presented in the Western media, is a really dangerous substance. You've just suggested that it isn't. But we were told this Novichok, tiny up things, it kills thousands, of the whole of Salisbury. And of course, we've also heard that the house, as I mentioned earlier, has been demolished because it's been contaminated with Novichok. And of course, we saw at the time people with hazmat suits going around the place. Meanwhile, police officers are standing in uniform right next to the people with hazmat suits. That doesn't make sense, does it? Why have they got a hazmat suit on and you're just standing there, not even with a face mask? No face nappy even.
Okay, so overall, Martin, anything to add about Navalny? What's going to happen? Is he going to survive? Is he going to be killed? Is he going to die of this poison?
Well, he is diabetic, because he's already said that, so that may well be that what we had here is just, let's just run through the logical possibilities. He's had a diabetic fit. Second, he's been poisoned, but not necessarily by Novichok. And if he has been poisoned, the question is who's done it. The head of the, not the GRU, but of the civilian intelligence services in Russia this morning was saying that we suspect Western foul play here. And of course, as I said on RT yesterday, what you've got is this ridiculous scenario whereby we all know that Western intelligence services don't do nasty things like kill anybody. And certainly not kill people like Navalny, who's friendly to the West.
So what would be the motive? Let's just wrap up with the motive. What's the motive, if it is the West?
Well, the motive is either related to what's going on in Belarus, which I don't think it probably is, because that's ongoing. What's very interesting is Angela Merkel, who is now being come under pressure from our own party and from the Green Party to cancel the Nord Stream 2 pipeline.
Okay,
which
so
I just
Nord Stream 2 is a pretty powerful motive.
Yes, it is. That's a very strong
motive. And also, of course, she said she's going to be standing down next year, so she's kind of on her way out anyway.
Yes, well,
so why wouldn't she?
Well, she basically has stood up to the American bullying and British bullying about Nord Stream 2 because there's a substantial section of the industrialist establishment in Germany that wants cheap gas from Russia for industrial reasons. Of course, we don't do industry in this country anymore, so it's of no interest to us. You know, we just do bank fraud and things of that sort. But in Germany, you've still got an industrial base, and they still want to make things. So for them, getting cheap gas, and of course, the problem with putting it through Poland, Poles are opposed to the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, because if there was going to be a pipeline, they wanted it to come through Poland. But both the Germans and the Russians are saying, yes, but then you can just turn off the tap at any time you want to, and we're not going to do that. And of course, that's what the problem with all the pipelines.
It's amazing,
isn't
it? How much political influence there is just through energy. Of course, that's one of the reasons why we had the Bitter Lake deal back in the Second World War between Abdulaziz from Saudi Arabia, and I think it wasn't it Roosevelt that did this big deal about oil, which has so massively influenced the post-World War II world. But look, rather than concentrate too much on what happened in Salisbury and the Novichok there, which you mentioned briefly, there is an entire completely different narrative, which I read, I think it was on the SACO website, Martin, which I'll put a link up on to our show page at thisweek.org.uk, which gives you a complete different potential take from the official narrative of what happened at Salisbury by looking at Litvinenko. Now, this guy Litvinenko died in 2006, apparently of polonium poisoning, but there are some suspicions about who really did it, aren't there? Not least from his own family, Martin.
Well, that's right. I mean, when something like
we're told Putin did it, but
Well, I mean, what don't forget, there's something called Operation Beluga. We know it's called Operation Beluga because Captain Paul Birrell of the French anti-terrorist squad, who was also a part of, he retired from the anti-terrorist squad, he's part of Berezovsky's security detail. But he said there is something called Operation Beluga, which is run by the Western Intelligence Services, CIA, MI6, etc. And what Operation Beluga is about, a bit like Gladio back in the day, is whenever there's a potential for rapprochement and sensible cooperation between Russia and elements in the West. So, for example, between German industrialists and Russian gas suppliers, then things happen to sabotage that. And this would fit that pattern to a T.
God, it sounds like an episode of The Avengers, you know, the old-fashioned 60s one. Anyway, Litvinenko, the Russian spy's brother, said he was killed by British agents. So his brother says that, and also Britain had more reasons to kill, apparently, Alexander Litvinenko than the Russians, claims the spy's brother. So we've got the brother saying very different things to what we've been hearing, and also his own father called Alexander Litvinenko a traitor. And he's begging forgiveness from Putin for Litvinenko being such a traitor. So various members of his own family, Martin, do not believe that Litvinenko was, you know, as we're being told, some sort of difficult opponent of Putin. Certainly one of the things I've heard is that he was actually quite a weedy guy. He certainly was nothing to do with the KGB, that he was an ex-policeman from St. Petersburg, who was in London offering protection to British people who were travelling out to the newly opened up Russia, saying, well, if you go over there on your own without a delegation, you're going to be in danger. But I can oil the wheels. I know all the KGB people. I'll make sure you've got close protection and you'll be safe. So some people fell for that. Most people who knew what they were doing didn't, because they realised that it was just the whole thing was a confidence trick, really. He was just wanting money in order to do this close protection work. But his big mistake, apparently, Martin, was blackmailing some of the big oligarchs in London, saying, well, I know secrets about you from Russia, and so you better give me some money. But those people are quite dangerous criminals, and if he's blackmailing them, then there's an enormous motive there for one of them to bump him off, not Putin.
One thing I noticed was that nobody came up with any analysis of this polonium, did they? I mean, I read somewhere that you should be able to analyse it and find out exactly where it came from, because it could have been Russia, or it could have been Israel, I think, has polonium.
Well, that's what he probably used to poison Arafat.
Yeah, there was polonium found in Arafat's toothbrush and in his mouth. So polonium was used to kill him, apparently, too.
Well, I mean,
but if they had analysed it and found it was Russia, then they'd have told us, wouldn't they? So that tends to imply that...
Well, they've implied that it is, but, you know, they've not said it. But, you know, they've implied that it must be Russian. You see, things like polonium and Novichok are at a certain level. It can't be just random gangsters. It's got to be the state, which is why they push the line that this is what's been used.
Yeah.
Now, what we were told at the time, if you remember, Tony, was that the reason why the Russians wanted him dead was because he'd written the book with Yuri Feltinsky about blowing up Russia. And of course,
now, this gets to the heart of it, hardly mentioned.
Now, people will remember what I call, or perhaps they don't, what I call 999, which was in September, the ninth month of 1999. Bombs went off in Moscow and in Ryazan, in working-class neighbourhoods, killed hundreds of people.
Well, let's just be really clear about this. They blew up, like, half of a tower block, basically.
Yes, I mean, they were basically...
These were big residential tower blocks, like we've got here in Barton Hill.
Yeah, and it was claimed that this was the Chechens.
Massive bombs, like 30, 40
people killed on each one. At the same time, Samuel Basiev, who was a sort of militant Chechen commander, invaded Dagestan. Now, none of this really adds up, because by that stage... The Chechens had won independence from Russia. They were already independent of Russia. There was no reason for them to do anything like that. So it didn't make a lot of sense from that point of view. But Berezovsky was working with Yeltsin, because Yeltsin had just been re-elected in 1998 by a tiny majority, because the West poured money in to make sure that he won in the first round by, you know, an infinitesimal. He had to get more than 50%, but so there wouldn't be a runoff. But of course, the reason being that the challenger to him was Gennady Zyuganov of the Communist Party, and they were looking as if they were going to win, yeah, because that's what happened everywhere else in Europe. The Communist Party won, but that wasn't acceptable to the Western powers. So what actually probably happened in Russia, in my view, to summarise, is that those bomb attacks in Russia were carried out with elements within the Russian security forces, but basically cooperating with Western security forces, doing the same kind of thing that they did at 9/11 and the same kind of thing they did at Bologna Railway Station in 1980. And, of course, people in Russia are well aware that there was no motive for the Chechens.
Well, one of those bombs was actually discovered, wasn't it, I think, by an ordinary policeman who contacted the FSB or whoever they are, state secret police, and they tried to make out that there was nothing to see. But he himself then got and defused one of the bombs in one of these tower blocks, so it never actually went off.
Well, one copper arrested some people who were acting suspiciously, and they were carrying a bomb, and they said, no, this is just a drill. Yeah, that's what he was told.
Yes, in other words, it is
possible that those bombs were planted from inside the security forces in Russia at the time. And I actually thought at the time that Putin was involved in it, because Putin had been appointed as Yeltsin's prime minister.
So he was acting prime minister.
And therefore, then Putin came forward and said, "All right, we're going to deal with this." And of course, Putin's power base came from that period, because he then took control as the prime minister. They reinvaded Chechnya. You know, they sorted things out. So it really built him up as some very important guy.
Berezovsky thought he was in. He had Putin in his pocket, didn't he?
That's right. Well, Berezovsky was friendly with. Basically, he was a manipulator, and he got Basiev to carry out a provocation in Dagestan. And, of course, he controlled NTV, which was the biggest TV station in Russia at the time, and they were pushing Putin as the answer to the problem of the Chechens, yeah? But it was all really about stopping the communists coming to power and renationalizing the economy.
Once Putin became president, he rather quickly went to the prosecutor's office and said, "What have you got on Berezovsky?"
Yeah, I mean, basically, Putin...
They fell out, didn't they?
Yeah, Putin and Berezovsky fell out because
Berezovsky got a phone call from Putin saying they're going to come and arrest you in the morning. I'm an old mate of yours, and I'm just telling you, best thing is get on a plane tonight to London or somewhere out.
I mean, what happened there is Putin was regarded as a safe pair of hands by the FSB, who at that stage cooperating with that CIA and MI6 to keep the communists out. And at the time, I thought this was really sinister, because we're going to get Putin running the country, who's actually in the pocket of the CIA. But it turned out he wasn't in the pocket of the CIA. He was in his own pocket.
Renegade, as they say.
Anyway, so, yes, he is a gangster, I think it's fair to say, Mr. Putin, but he wants to be number one gangster in Russia. He's not having any of the oligarchs telling him what to do in the Kremlin.
He's no more or less of a gangster than Brigadier Gordon Kerr.
Well, I'd say he's more. He's certainly got more power, hasn't he?
Mm.
But anyway, the idea is that you're not going to allow organised crime to push the Kremlin around.
Well, no, ultimately, no. I mean, what's happened and why they're very hostile to Russia today, not the TV station, but Russia today, is because they've basically rebuilt the state on a more democratic basis than the United States of America. I mean, elections in Russia are pretty much free and fair. And the people with the most votes win. And, of course, they're not going to privatise their natural resources.
You can check that by looking at opinion polls, I suppose.
Yes.
Finally, on this topic, Martin, what about Belarus? There's been a few shakes there. It's a little bit like Venezuela. The Western press, the Western establishment doesn't really seem to like the result.
No, and I think what happened at the beginning, Lukashenko is a bit of a control freak. He got elected 26 years ago because Belarus managed, as the Soviet Union broke up, Belarus just fell out of the Soviet Union. So it's a tiny country with less than 10 million inhabitants, largely not completely rural, but it's got a lot of big rural sector. And it was a backwater, really. And Lukashenko was a collective farm manager, a bit like Grudinin in Russia, who was the communist candidate at the last election there. And basically, he basically promised the population, we're not going to do anything to change things much around here. We're going to keep the collective farms going. They've still got collective farms in Belarus, and they employ people. People work all their lives, and then they get a pension, and they function. They've allowed them to collapse in other parts of Eastern Europe, which was absolutely disastrous for the rural population. But in Belarus, the rural population looked after. So all the grannies, you know, are looked after. And the big state factories, the Minsk tractor factory, the fertilizer factory, they employ thousands of people. And they've not been privatised, and everybody's still in work.
And if it's a successful socialist country, you may as well just carry on.
Well, that's the reason he was able to do that is because they get very cheap oil and gas from Russia itself. If he didn't have that, he would have had to take him a more...
It's all back to energy again, isn't it?
Yes, it is. But anyway, the point about it is, the reason I'm mentioning all of that is because a lot of Western analysis of what's happened there has failed to answer the basic questions, how has he stayed in power for 26 years? And the answer is, a bit like Shinzo Abe in the Liberal Democratic Party in Japan, it's because people vote for him. Now, of course, he's a bit of a control freak, so he basically, anybody that he perceived as opposition, he used to harass them, and, you know, he didn't really allow them to have a say. And, of course, that basically infuriated a younger generation. I mean, if you're a younger IT professional from Belarus, he's been in power, you know, you're less than 26 years old, he's been in power all your life. And, of course, you're fed up with him, and you'd like to see some change. But if you're an older rural voter... basically, he's delivered what he said. He does exactly what it says on the tin. We're not going to do anything like... And, of course, during the 1990s, when Yeltsin was in power in Russia, and they tried to privatise everything, and there was 1,000% inflation and collapsing economy, Belarus just chugged along. Backwater. And, in factual fact, they want to be a backwater.
And we mentioned Venezuela mentioned Venezuela, comparing it a little bit to the Belarus elections. Well, the Americans have been condemning that election in Venezuela last year, but they're now saying there's going to be another vote in December this year. But the Americans, Pompeo is saying to the Venezuelan opposition, boycott the election.
That's because they know they can't win. Whereas what happened in Belarus was they had the election, and the opposition did rather better than they've done in previous elections, but they still only got 10%. It might be, if they had a fairer go, they'd have about double that and got 20%. Let's be generous. And then a younger generation were definitely encouraged to go out and protest against it. And of course, for young people, he's just an old guy. What the hell's he doing there? You know, you can imagine, you know. And then the police, very stupidly, beat everybody up on social media. And so all the friends of the people who were beaten up then came out to protest, and on it went. And if you see what happened last Sunday in Minsk, quite a big demonstration, but it's not big enough to overthrow the government, and the police just blocked the way to the presidential palace. And I think what they're going to do now is people will carry on protesting. But he's not, you know, basically what the West has got to recognise is that Lukashenko won the election. That's just fairly obvious. And you can huff and you can puff and say it wasn't fair. And what the, from the point of view of the West, he's just, well, why is he still there? They've still got collective farms, state-owned factories, virtually well, full
it's
employment.
There, it's there
there's no unemployment
it's
in Belarus.
A fairly successful country. Anyway, let's get on to talk about 9/11 now. We've got Ian Henshaw with us. Thank you very much, Ian, for coming up to Bristol to be with us today. We're going to start by having a listen to a guy called Richard Clark, and it'd be interesting if you could, first of all, tell us a little bit about your first... You know, when did you put pen to paper and start writing about 9/11? Because I love the books. They're very, very simple. They're very clear, and actually, there's almost all the information you need in there to just understand. And this is what this is all about: understanding that the official story we were sold back in 2001 was a pup.
Yeah, well, that's true. Who actually did 9/11 is, you know, I would say pretty much unknown. You said it was evidence pointing to Israel. I personally don't see much evidence pointing to Israel. I think it's a bit like peeling an onion. You don't really know what you're going to find in the middle when you start peeling off the layers. And the two layers that are peeling off very badly from the point of view of the American establishment are the two layers are, first of all, the CIA's role and the FBI's role in facilitating a path for the alleged hijackers. And the other issue is, I'm so sorry, Martin, I've,
Martin. Okay, can we just, because you did mention the Israeli, you mentioned the Israeli angle there. I mean, we've covered quite a lot of times. There's a terrific, I think, terrific article out there called 9/11, Israel Did It. It's on the Wikispooks site. And it does go into quite a lot of detail about the key Zionist network assets, you know, things like World Trade Center security, airport security, and where Israeli firms were involved at some key points during the 9/11 attacks. So, Martin, can we just, before we move on, I mean, this is almost, we should be covering this at the end. But what, you know, what do you make of the whodunit question about 9/11 before we get into some of the details?
Well, I think Ian's being absolutely right there, because it's more important really to show that their story is wrong.
Yeah.
Questions of whodunit we can enter into. I'm perfectly happy to discuss whodunit. We've got very, obviously, if we were police officers, we'd have suspicions of whodunit. But the most important thing people need to get is that the official story is just impossible. It's similar to what we were talking about, the logical impossibilities in the Skripal case and all the rest
of it. Okay, well, I think it's quite... I quite like the idea of setting out right at the very beginning this possibility, and that's no more than that, that it was the Israeli state behind it. Listing a few people who put their name to that opinion. We've got Christopher Bolin. We've got a guy called Professor Anthony Hall, who I met through you, actually, Ian, who's a Canadian professor, written a book called Earth into Property, which is fantastic. Professor Kees van der Peel, Paul Craig Roberts, Rebecca Roth, Alan Sobroski, former head of studies, I think he was at the U.S. Army War College, and the Reverend Stephen Sizer from Victoria Water in London. All these names, pretty much, these I think are fairly, you know, normal, sensible people that would say that. But let's to put that to one side for a minute. Who done it? Let's get into some of the detail and start actually on 9/11 itself, on the actual day of the attacks. And here is a guy who's quite important. We're going to hear from now, a guy called Richard Clark. So can you just tell us a little bit about him before we hear from him?
Well, yeah. Richard Clark, in my opinion, is the most important 9/11 whistleblower. He was the head of counterterrorism at the White House at the time. So everything that the CIA was doing and the FBI were doing legally went through Richard Clark up to Condoleezza Rice and Dick Cheney and President Bush.
So obviously he's quite an interesting person to hear from.
He is an expert, you know.
He was right in the middle of it, in the decision-making
right.
on the day.
And when he condemned the Bush administration 2 years later in public at the investigation, the investigation into it, the King Commission. He was lauded throughout the world, you know, all the media, he was on the front pages. And then suddenly, when he said something that was not welcome, i.e. the CIA had played a hand in this, and I know because I was their boss, and I know what they didn't tell me and they should have told me. When he came out and said that, total silence. Nobody's interested.
These errors of omission are fascinating to me. I find where someone who's supposed to be being told is just not told the stuff. We had that back in the 1970s under the Wilson government, where the Secret Services decided Wilson was a British spy, so they supplied all of the...
Russian spy.
Sorry?
It wasn't a British spy.
A Russian spy, yeah. And so they supplied all the intelligence to a certain Mr. James Callaghan, who I think was Home Secretary at the time. So Callaghan, sitting around the cabinet table in the 70s, was far, far more in the loop than even was the Prime Minister. He was kept out of the loop. Mm. So that's why this sort of thing is so important. Richard Clarke wasn't being told. Anyway, let's have a listen to his account of what happened on 9/11 itself.
We had what we thought was state-of-the-art high-tech. We had a wall with about 8 TV monitors. Mm. And I could hold a meeting from there, from the Situation Room. And so I had the Secretary of Defense and the CIA Director and the Deputy Secretary of State and FBI Director and everybody all in one meeting all day long. The beauty of that was they could stay in their command centers. And we ran the operation from there all day. And did things that we had never done before. You know, like very early in the day, I said, let's ground all the aircraft. And the FAA director said, well, we've never done that. I'm not sure we can do that. And we said, well, try. And it worked. We got every aircraft down in about an hour. There were like 2,400 aircraft aloft. There were aircraft coming in from Europe, which we landed in Canada.
Yeah.
Aircraft coming in from the Pacific, which we either turned around or landed in Canada. It was a very intense day where we went to nuclear alert. The first time since 1973 that we went to DEFCON 3. We buttoned down the country pretty quickly. We closed all the borders, closed all the harbors, because we didn't know what was coming next. There were 4 aircraft that had been hijacked. We initially were told the number was 11. And we were told one of them was headed toward us, toward the White House. And I think probably one of them was either headed toward us or the Capitol. And I'm not sure where it was going to go, one or the other. But it took a damn long time for us to get fighter aircraft over the city. Damn long time.
I watched them. I was in D.C., and I remember I was outside, and they swooped down, and I thought it was the enemy. I was face down in the, literally in a field in Washington.
I kept screaming all morning for CAP, for Combat Air Patrol cover, and finally when they got it, just to prove to me that they did it, they had 2 F-15s go right over the White House at about 100 feet right off the ground.
I saw them. Yeah. Right.
I heard them.
That was something. Yeah. What was going through your mind? Because you, in a career that had built to that point for you, you'd been thinking about this. You'd chase Ramzi Youssef.
I mean, we knew.
You knew it was bin Laden.
I knew it was bin Laden. I knew, you know, for maybe 9 months from intelligence reporting that al-Qaeda was planning a major attack on the U.S., CIA told me it would be overseas, but I had no reason to believe them. With their track record, they're not always right.
Right.
So we knew there would be a major al-Qaeda attack. What we didn't know was where, when, exactly. I thought it would be around the first week in July, off a couple of months. Where, when, or how. We did not know that they were going to hijack aircraft. Obviously.
So that's Richard Clarke there. He also has come out with more stuff, hasn't he? And I think he even wrote a book about it, Ian.
Well, he did. He wrote a very good book, which raised a few doubts and had some interesting facts in it. For instance, he explained in his book that exercises can be really, really live. You know, they're not just like, you know, sort of putative things. They would even have a fake press conference at the end of an exercise if it was in something involving something that would be of political interest to the public. But it wasn't really until he gets started giving interviews years later that the full enormity of what he was saying came out. And basically, he says that the CIA were running the alleged 9/11 hijackers. They were running them with the help and support of the Saudi, and this is where I would, you know, we might have a disagreement.
Well, that's it. No, it's interesting, though, that he's actually having a go at the CIA there on TV.
Yeah.
So he does, he's saying, look, these guys you can't trust.
Well, he was already beginning to suspect, I think, right from day one, how come the CIA never told me any inkling of this? These guys must, he would know as a national security professional that it's not that easy to infiltrate hijackers and, you know, fundamentalist hijackers, 15 of them, and have them living in America without anybody detecting them. And of course, they had been detected. They'd been very thoroughly detected by the FBI, who was stymied by the CIA, even though the FBI were legally in charge in the United States, on United States territory. They were stymied by the CIA, who basically blocked the information. And there's an FBI guy on the CIA top secret Osama bin Laden unit who is furious about it, Mark Rossini. He says justice hasn't been done. They blocked the information and there's something very, very dodgy. That's my words, those last ones. There's something very, very dodgy about all this. So, you know, there's no lack of whistleblowers any longer. And the reason I often emphasize this side of it when I'm interviewed, rather than the issue about the towers collapsing, which is the other side, of course, of the 9/11 issue, is because this is all paper trail stuff, which lawyers and people like that, if you go to a lawyer and say, I don't think those towers collapsed, it was too suspicious, he's going to say, well, I'm a lawyer, you know, go and not speak to an architect about it. But of course, the country is run by lawyers, not by architects. So if you want to get to the establishment, I think it's better to go for the paper trail side, the people like Richard Clarke. Now, Richard Clarke is not saying the CIA organized 9/11, so as to, you know, but what he is saying is they've got an awful lot that they kept secret. They've got an awful lot of questions to answer. And obviously, people, it's unthinkable to him. He was friendly with all these people. They were his life, you know. And it's very difficult to come to face the fact that somebody you've known for all your life is a mass murderer. And I've actually haven't had to do that myself, so I don't know who I'm, but you know what I mean. It's, you can quite understand Richard Clarke, and also for tactical reasons, doesn't want to come out and say, you know, well, actually the CIA organized 9/11. And then on the other hand, of course, you've got the FBI side of it, where FBI agents are speaking up and there are court cases which are trying to force the FBI to release what it knows, the information it knows. The families of 9/11 victims, even the ones who aren't accusing the CIA of anything, they're still furious as well. And of course, we've got a family member in England who's just hoping to have his inquest reopened.
Okay, that's Matt Campbell.
That's right, Matt Campbell. He's very brave, intelligent, and, you know, a really wonderful guy. I know him. I've become friendly with him since this started. And his brother, Jeff, you know, they found his head. Matt is, you know, he's been through a lot. And he's now, they're trying to raise money to reopen the inquest, which, of course, took place in the UK. So it could be, you know, it's theoretically possible that the UK will lead, you know, the opening up of the 9/11 issue, but it's very unlikely.
Well, one of the most incredible bald-faced lies about the whole thing is that we've got, you know, the Saudi Arabians really at the heart of this. All these hijackers are Saudis. Now, there's this rather tense relationship, isn't there, between Donald Trump and Saudi Arabia with these various threats to release large areas of up till now hidden reports about Saudi involvement.
Well, I don't think there's much doubt that the Saudis, I was talking about peeling an onion. I mean, one of the layers of that onion is the Saudi involvement. But the Saudis have always sort of like done the dirty work, because see, what happens with Saudi Arabia is if you expose them, as has been done really over 9/11, I can tell you why if we've got time, they just say, Well, you know, what do you expect? The Saudis, you know, primitive country. We can't do anything about it. We depend on them for oil. So, you know, in the national interest, we're not going to look that way. Even though we're going to invade Afghanistan, we're going to destroy Iraq, we're not going to look at Saudi Arabia, who actually supplied 15 of the hijackers. And, of course, John Brennan, now this is an interesting, you heard this first here, Tony. John Brennan, who has been leading the attacks on President Trump, coordinating them, ex-head of the CIA, promoted by Obama, that nice Mr. Obama, he was actually the CIA station chief in Riyadh in the years leading up to 9/11. So that guy, who was at the very heart of Saudi-US relations, is now running the campaign against Trump, who's threatened to reveal things about 9/11. Now, I personally don't believe Trump. I think he's just a con man. But, you know, a lot of people do still trust him and believe him. And, you know, it must be very frightening if you were helping to organize 9/11 to see Trump in the White House in the position, as I was saying earlier, you know, with accountable democracy. The only person who can achieve, you know, a righteous outcome is the President of the United States.
Well, there's another chap as well who was very much involved in 9/11, whose name we've been hearing recently, and that's a guy called Robert Mueller.
Mueller.
He apparently played a significant role in covering up the Saudi and the British role in the 9/11 attacks, wholesale destruction of the US Constitution, which followed in its wake. That is, things like the intelligence services being put in charge of Homeland Security, this sort of thing. So what was Robert Mueller's role? Because we know him as the FBI chief prosecutor of Donald Trump, various prosecutions that went nowhere and attempts at impeachment. But where was he on 9/11? What was he up to?
Well, I think Mueller had only just moved into the FBI at that point. I think he's just a sort of, you know, safe pair of hands.
But he's one of these people who... he's involved in this cover-up on the 9/11, and then he has this amazing astronomical rise right up to the top of the FBI.
Well, he was the head of the FBI. I'd have to check this. It's so long ago now, but I think you'll find he was the head of the... he'd just been parachuted in as head of the FBI just before 9/11. And he, funnily enough, he actually gave quite a valuable quote to 9/11 skeptics. He said, I'm paraphrasing him here. He said, "It's very surprising that in all our investigations into 9/11, we never ever found a paper trail leading back to Osama bin Laden." So actually Mueller, you know, he's hedging his bets a bit. You know, he's putting in a bit to ingratiate himself if the truth ever comes out. He can say, look, he said that. But at the same time, you know, he's not into making trouble for himself, and he didn't get to where he was by making trouble for anybody, that's for sure, as with so many bureaucrats in Washington. But I personally think Brennan's a more interesting character.
Martin?
Well, I'm just listening to what's being said. I mean, all of the detail that Ian is on top of, I tend to just go for basic stuff which I can understand.
Well, we heard a bit there about the non-appearance of the Air Force, didn't we?
Well, indeed, yeah. Yes. Yeah. I mean, there's a simple question. Where was the United States Air Force?
He's saying, I'm calling for combat air patrol, but it didn't appear.
Yeah. Well, we know what happened. There was an exercise of an attack over the North Pole by the Russians, and they were all been taken off out of the United States and sent to Canada. That's why there was hardly any planes there. Again, very suspicious.
There was some at the Andrews Air Base, yes, which we never...
Well, indeed. And also, of course, Condoleezza Rice said, who could have imagined that people would fly planes into buildings?
Of course, anybody could have imagined. Yes, well, and
well,
it is.
And in any case, they were actually carrying out an exercise on that day of planes flying into buildings,
yes,
I understand.
Yes, absolutely.
And therefore, some people were saying, is this real or is this the exercise?
Well, my personal interest is exactly what did happen, and they're on record saying that. And, you know, if you ask me, we're all talking about, you know, our little pet theories about who really lay behind it, deeply behind it. You know, I think you're going to find that it was...
Come on. Who was behind it? Come on.
Oh, no, he's not going to tell us now.
Spit it out, Ian.
Well, I think you're going to find it was basically the American military-industrial complex. And the reason I resist accusations against Israel is Israel might do something like that. They might think of it. But, you know, what a risk to take. You know, why not get people in America to do it. You know, people who can protect themselves in the future.
But some people, real big winners, take big risks, don't they?
Can I just say, the linkages between the military-industrial complex in the US, the British military and the Israeli military, they're almost one organisation.
Yeah, I know.
It's like saying the difference between the UDA and the UVF.
One of the things that you quite often hear from writers like George Monbiot, for example, in The Guardian, is that, you know, why is there that nobody's blown the whistle on this? Well, actually, quite a few people have blown the whistle, and one of them we're going to hear from now is a chap called Philip Marshall, who wrote a book called The Big Bamboozle and The War on Terror. He's a former airline pilot, and he was very outspoken about all of this, and unfortunately died not long after he published his book in horrific circumstances. I think his children as well were murdered. A gunman came into his home. So tell us a little bit about Philip Marshall, Ian.
Well, he came from nowhere, you know. He was typical of the 9/11 truth movement. He was somebody who believed the official story, because you do, you know, and he eventually started looking at the details. I can't remember what prompted him. And he realized that he'd had dealings with the CIA for other periods of his life. And he realized that actually, you know, this story wasn't true. And he looked into it, and he decided that his particular scenario was that he thought that they'd trained the Saudi hijackers and they really were flying the planes into the buildings. Now, a lot of people don't believe that. A lot of people think they were run on autopilot, because it would have been too difficult for people with those skill levels to do that.
So, it's Executive Intelligence Review, LaRouche, have an article, Was It Murder? Philip Marshall, author of The Big Bamboozle, is dead, published on the 15th of March 2013.
Yeah.
A veteran airline pilot published The Big Bamboozle, they say, 9/11 and the War on Terror, which documents the role of Saudi Arabia in running, so there's another culprit potentially, September the 11th attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon, and of the Bush presidency in facilitating it by standing down the Air Force. 1 year later, on February the 2nd, 2013, after the book was published, Marshall was found dead along with his two teenage children and his dog in his home in California. Anyway, let's have a listen now to the great, the wonderful Philip Marshall talking about what he called The Big Bamboozle.
They had all these reports, supposedly, that went up to the White House. And those reports kept saying that, oh, this guy Bin Laden's getting ready to strike. But, you know, as an airline captain at that time, no one told me there was a threat out there. No one told Jason Dahl or anybody else that these threats were out there. So I thought it was really interesting. And when I looked into the evidence on Bin Laden, you know, through the congressional inquiry, who looked into it for a long time, almost a year, there's no operational evidence at all on Bin Laden. They have 80 pages worth on the Saudi intelligence.
On the cover of your book is the seal of the intelligence community. Why is that seal there?
It mentioned the intelligence community a lot. You hear it a lot on the media, but you really don't know what it is. And I started picking up that whoever this intelligence community was, they were the ones in the reports that kept saying, oh, the intelligence community says that Bin Laden is behind 9/11 because, and then there was nothing after the because, really, except for that he wrote a fatwa back in 1998. So that's the only evidence that's cited anywhere, is that he wrote a fatwa that he was going to strike the United States. So I started looking in, okay, so who is the intelligence community? We present this evidence of who the intelligence community is. They're every armed authority of the United States as a result of 9/11, as a result of the attack. They control the Department of Homeland Security, the TSA, the CIA, the FBI, the energy. And the big one is the United States Treasury. They have learned how to go around our Congress and tap directly into the Treasury. And those are our tax dollars that are sitting there as the grand prize for anyone that has taken over the United States government, is that they get to the Treasury. And they control the Treasury. I think from now on, anyone who reads this book will know the rest of their life, when they hear in the intelligence community, what exactly that is. And it's being run from a 1.4 million square foot building called the George Bush Center of Intelligence, right outside of Washington. So the way I see it is that they have overpowered our government they have overpowered the three branches of equal power with scare tactics. We got to throw all of our money at terrorism. So $15 trillion has disappeared since the time that George W. Bush took over. They spent every penny that we've sent them in our taxes, and then $15 trillion on top of that. So I'm wondering, where did all that money go, and who's controlling that money? It's a pattern that I was studying before that. The BCCI scandal was very fishy type. They got into the Treasury, and billions of dollars disappear almost on a daily basis for the last 10 years.
And, of course, you know, the one thing, he wasn't very articulate, but he did miss out one power center, of course, I would say the most important, actually, and that is the media, the Washington media. I mean, they are the CIA, you know, they sort of almost are the CIA.
Well, in fact, we know, don't we, about Operation Mockingbird going on for many, many decades, where it started off with just a spy in every newsroom, going on to actually controlling the editorial policy of every major media outlet in the country.
Yeah, and we had that German journalist explaining how, I forget his name.
Rudolf Urquhart.
Yeah, explaining how exactly the same thing happens in Germany.
By the way, this book is just out in English, isn't it, recently?
Is it? Yes, yeah. Yes, it will have been. Yeah, Progressive Press, I think, published it, didn't they?
Yeah, so all these various agencies. He's saying, basically, Martin there is, I think, brilliant, articulate guy. There he is speaking, 7 years ago or so, 8 years ago, before someone came into his house and murdered him, the rest of his family and his dog. Whoever that was.
And just in case anybody thought it was, the official story was true, that he committed suicide, the local police refused to the behaviour of the local police and the local prosecutors was evidence in itself, if not proof, that his death was highly suspicious.
How? What did they do?
They refused to investigate. They just obstructed.
Okay, so this case is hands off. Someone gave him a call.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Yeah.
No, don't touch it, please.
They wouldn't. And they got quite threatening when some of the
Martin,
neighbors...
the interesting thing about him is a little bit like Robin Cook, in fact. He's extremely articulate. And this is, I think, in some ways, what the dark side fear the most. Somebody like him is a airline professional pilot, written a book, and not only that, he's incredibly articulate there in explaining. This is the real problem. Somebody has gone round the whole governmental process and they're now running things behind the scenes, whether it's the judiciary, the legislature, or the president. You may as well forget it because they're controlling all of them.
Yeah, well, and he's an interesting character, obviously, but he hasn't got inside knowledge as such. He's basically somebody who's an outsider.
To a certain extent, I mean, he's had dealings with the CIA in the past.
Yes,
apparently.
He's had dealings with the CIA and he's an airline pilot, and therefore he is a... You know, and especially
I wouldn't say all airline pilots have had dealings with.
No, but I mean, if he wants to shout his mouth off, he's definitely going to be a target potentially, isn't he?
In which case, he's rather a brave guy.
Well, indeed, and of course, we've also, let's mention here William Rodriguez, who is the janitor in the World Trade Center, and he came over here some years ago. We'll all remember. Telling his story of what happened
at
on the
Bristol,
day.
Yeah,
what happened on the day, and you know. He said there were definitely bombs in the building. And of course, Donald Trump said soon after the events, those buildings were definitely bombed. I build buildings like that for a living. And though the airplanes can't just crash into buildings and make them crash like that, the buildings were definitely bombed.
I'm not so sure about your New York accent.
Well, all right. But anyway. But I think as people go to the polls in the US, they ought to dig that up and listen to what he's saying. Because of course, Trump, being a chump, is just coming out with the obvious. Buildings like that do not collapse. And we're obviously going to come to that in a moment, but we're still dealing with, what you might call the paper trail. But, there's some pretty obvious stuff which just doesn't add up.
Anyway, for me, the big hiatus for me was watching a video called 9/11 in Plain Sight, which I think was, it must have been around about beginning of 2003, so that's about 18 months or 2 years after the 9/11 attacks, which really used video evidence from the day itself, Ian, really to show, well, hang on, this and this does not, you know, one and one doesn't make two here. It is not actually adding up at all. So there is all sorts of evidence in those videos which showed. I mean, one of the basic things was to do with the firefighters on the day were saying in that film, it was just there were explosives in the buildings, effectively. Mm. So this is another side of this, isn't it? More people are now coming out and saying there are explosives in the buildings, folks. So who put those there? Was it Bin Laden?
Well, exactly. One of the developments, you know, in the sort of research side in the last year is that some very energetic researchers have gone through all the cuttings, you know, all the information bases, and they've found 36 reliable people, like, so not just like the kid round the block, but, you know, professional journalists, etc., who all went on record saying that there were explosions. I mean, it looked like an explosion. It was called an explosion by perhaps most of the people who saw it. But the official story, of course, couldn't allow that because it would be not, wouldn't be credible that a bomb.
The thing is, you can see it in the films of the collapse of the World Trade Center and Building 7. It's, you know, there's these little explosions coming out one by one, controlled demolition.
That's right. And you've got, for instance, the things flying out. I think what's more difficult to explain, you can come up with explanations, for, you know, for some of these phenomena. But the one that I think they've got the most trouble with is where you see very, very heavy beams flying horizontally at high speed. Now, you know, anybody out there who's got O-level physics, GCSE physics or above, will know, have heard about conservation of momentum.
Well, so was there any evidence of explosives in the actual wreckage afterwards?
Well, yes, there was, but most of it was sent to Japan for recycling.
It was very quickly tidied up, wasn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, very quickly, yeah.
Let's get rid of the evidence, guys.
But actually, you know, once again, we were discussing this with the paper trail. It's there on the paper trail. You know, the official investigation, the first official investigation, they found vaporized steel. They found signs of vaporization of the steel. Now, you know, could that be caused by just a building collapse? Vaporization is quite a lot to happen to steel, you know. And so that was never explained.
But the thing is, I mean, it's surely but surely this has been unravelling, hasn't it? It was maybe only for really a few months, maybe a year, a couple of years, that people really believed that story. And now, slowly but surely, it's unravelled. It's almost, but it's too late for it to unravel. It doesn't really matter anymore because the war on terror started. It's happened. It's rolling.
Its
running.
Now they've got COVID.
Yeah, so what's the point in looking into this now still?
Well, because it's, I think it is worth setting the record straight. You know, in future, people need to see the precedent. If you know, because the criminals, they have a much more short-term outlook. They just want to get lots of money and not get caught. So they don't really care as much.
The same as the City of London,
funnily. Well, in this culture, who doesn't? You know, the criminals don't have that much of a long-term perspective. And it's easier to get them 20 years late.
Anyway, I mentioned the video in plain sight, the documentary. I think it was about half an hour long. I looked at it and I thought, right, okay, so my suspicions are confirmed here. This really does need to be properly unravelled. I was a little bit slow. Martin, you were a bit quicker, weren't you? I think it was almost on the day you got stuck in.
Yeah, well, the first thing I noticed was that I realised immediately that this was some kind of false flag attack. And I then started using the internet. So up to that point, I hardly
used the internet. What did you actually do?
I just went on the internet for the first time, and the first thing I discovered, because I knew what I was looking for, was that John O'Neill, the former deputy director of the FBI, had given a press conference in July with Boris Sardandeski, who were ex-French intelligence agents, saying that Bush was protecting bin Laden. And that was already out there. So I just turned it into a leaflet, and I went to a seminar at the LSE about 2 or 3 weeks after the attack, where Mort Dworkin III, political attaché at the US Embassy, was debating with Peter Gowan, who's an old friend of mine, about the future of US power. And I handed out leaflets about it at that event.
Did he notice you?
Well, no,
he's at the front.
I had a run-in with him at the end. Now, the point...
So did you actually speak at the meeting?
Yes, I tried to speak. I had to pay 25 quid to get in, but I couldn't get a word in edgewise, because you can imagine there's an awful lot of windbags who want to talk about the future of American power.
Oh, God.
Everybody's an expert on that sort of thing, especially when they pay 25 quid to get in there. So I knew immediately there was a problem, and the first thing I picked up was that. But of course, I then started looking at other things.
Did you actually get to talk to him in the meeting?
Yes. Not in the meeting.
Did you make the point?
I stood up in the meeting with a little sign saying, question, why did the FBI man resign? Answer, because Bush was protecting Bin Laden, and the security grabbed hold of me because I was in the LSE and hustled me off, because the problem for the LSE is if they invite the US embassy to come and speak at things and then people protest them in the meetings, they're not going to come again. And so the security just took me out to the front. I said, okay, I'm going.
Well, the political attaché at the US embassy won't come on this
program. Well, anyway, so I went out and I got a little leaflet about it, which I'd run up, you know, and I directed people to the book. I didn't know at that stage that John O'Neill had died in the Twin Towers.
Yeah.
I thought he was still alive. But, of course, he actually took over as head of security in the Twin Towers
on the
day of the attack. And he died in the attack.
He may have been killed, actually.
Well, no, I think some people have suggested that they didn't just leave it to chance, that they went round to his office before the attack came in and made sure that he wasn't going to escape. But anyway, I didn't know that at the time. All I knew is he'd written this book. It was a book in French at that stage. Anyway, so I handed the leaflets out, and I had chats with various people. Bonnie Greer was there, if you know her. So I had a chat with her. And then I was basically getting bored. I was about an hour and a half, and I thought he must have gone out the back way.
So you were hanging around.
I was hanging around,
waiting for him
to come out. But then it turned out that there was no back way. But he'd been waiting inside because he didn't want to come out. Because I was allowed to stand on the... I said to the security, can I stand here? This isn't LSE property. He said, yes, fine. As long as it's not on the property, you're okay. So anyway, he eventually came out, and I went up to him and I said, you do know that the deputy director of the FBI resigned in July because he said Bush was protecting Bin Laden. And he said to me, yeah, John O'Neill, we know. And I said, well, we know too, matey, and don't you forget it. And I just walked away at that point. And that's how that went.
Thank you. Nice little story, Martin. Now we're going to go to Dave von Kleist, who is the producer of the 9/11 in Plain Sight documentary, because he's not one to mince words. And here he is talking about the immediate reaction by the dark side and by people who don't like to think these things through to this whole idea of, oh, they're just a bunch of conspiracy theorists.
The immediate knee-jerk reaction most people will have when this topic is discussed is that people, those of you that are fixated on this 9/11 issue, are a bunch of conspiracy theorists. So with that in mind, let's look at the definition of conspiracy theory. I mean, that's the word conspiracy. If you play word association and ask somebody to think of the first word that you can think of after you hear the word conspiracy, most people will say theory. And that's because we've all been trained to associate theory with conspiracy. So in other words, no conspiracies are real. They're all just theories. So let's define what is a conspiracy theory. Conspiracy, by definition, is when two or more people plan something in secret. All right. Theory, by definition, is a supposition, a concept, an idea. For example, in theory, if I purchase a raffle ticket, I can win a prize. Now, once I purchase a raffle ticket, it's no longer a theory. It becomes a possibility. And the more raffle tickets that I purchase, the more possible and eventually probable the win becomes. And such is the case with a conspiracy theory. When you have no evidence to support the contention of a conspiracy, then indeed it is a conspiracy theory. But once you have a piece of evidence, no matter how flimsy or circumstantial it may be, the idea of a conspiracy becomes a possibility. And the more evidence that you amass to support the contention of a conspiracy, the more probable and eventually likely that conspiracy is. So if you apply that towards the official story, I remember that on September 18th, a week after the attacks on September 11th, Condoleezza Rice did a news conference, and she stated, and I'm paraphrasing, I might be quoting her word for word, she said, "We have definitive proof and evidence that links Osama bin Laden to the attacks on September 11th, and we will release this information in due time." Now, to this day, there has never been any information released or any evidence that proves or links Osama bin Laden to the September 11th attacks. So if you apply the official story to the term conspiracy theory, they charged Osama bin Laden with a conspiracy to destroy the Twin Towers. and to attack America. However, they never provided any evidence to support that contention. So by definition, that means that the official story is a conspiracy theory because they never provided any evidence to support it.
Well, that's Dave Von Kleist, who lost his radio show over in the United States. I think he was on the GCN network or somewhere like that. Unfortunately, some of the most clear thinkers seem to be censored in this whole world. But what do you make of that, Ian? He's making a pretty pretty convincing argument there that the official story is actually a conspiracy theory, so everybody else is probably closer to the truth.
Yeah, well, I mean, I obviously, you know, that's what they try to smear us with. So, you know, one gives it a bit of thought. Nowadays, I don't give it so much thought. I just think, oh, well, that just shows that they haven't got anything better to say. A bit like Boris Johnson in Parliament today, smearing, you know, the Labour leader. And also, I would have to just mention that, because they'll bring this up, you know, that Osama bin Laden was quite happy to see it happen. And there's some evidence that he tried to take credit for it afterwards in videos, which are disputed. Some people say they're false. Some people say, no, they're not all false. One or two of them are genuine. And he made a lot of radio broadcasts. I think what happened was that Khalid Sheikh Mohammed organized it. And as the, you know, the independent newspapers said, he was actually a Pakistani ISI agent. And he was a very good organizer. And, the 9/11 commission found that he was not actually one of Osama bin Laden's closest friends at all. He just foisted himself. So he seems to be the key guy. And that's why I've predicted for years now, so he'll never be brought to trial.
Well, what about to the dancing Israelis, for example? What were they doing there? Are they organised by Khalid Sheikh Mohammed?
Well, the problem with the dancing Israelis is that nobody's actually proved that they were there before the events happened. And if you could prove that, and it's been
stated...
But
they were filming the event.
No.
Martin?
Well, they were arrested, and they went on television in Israel saying, we are Mossad agents, and we were filming... The first attack, because we were documenting it.
No,
they're on the record
they
of saying
didn't
that.
Say, they never said we. They there's no evidence that they were there on the roof with their filming before the first plane hit. That's what you need to prove, that they had foreknowledge. Anybody can run up to the roof afterwards.
Well,
after
no, but
the
woman
hit.
The woman who saw them said that when the first plane hit the building, they were on the roof of a car. And that they started lighting lighters and doing high fives. So that she then took the number of the car, gave it to the police, and later in the day they were arrested.
Yeah, but I dispute what you're saying about that she saw them on the roof before the first plane hit. That's obviously
well,
absolutely
they claimed
crucial.
What she saw. Australian television claimed, when they were on Israeli television, they claimed they were in New York City that morning to document the event. That's what they claimed on the Israeli
TV. They were speaking in Hebrew, which most people don't understand. I don't understand. But the best translation I've seen says that they went up to the roof to document the event. That's a translation from Hebrew, so it's not terribly reliable as to its exact nuance. The question is there any, when they seize their footage, was there any pictures of the tower before the plane hit it? And there wasn't.
Good question. Anyway, finally on 9/11...
I mean, I'm sorry, don't get me wrong. I'm not saying that Israel's definitely had no part in this at all.
No, fine.
But it's important not to jump to conclusions, especially when you're dealing with such a powerful lobby.
Okay. Aaron Russo, he was a Hollywood film director... who had all sorts to say about the September the 11th attacks, and I think it's well worth having a listen to his comments now. He's another one, like Philip Marshall, who's passed away since.
By creating 9/11, an event to terrify the American people that were being attacked by terrorists, you create a world where there's an enemy that can never be pinpointed. You can never win the battle. It's a 100-year war. It's a never-ending war on terrorism, right? So you're always fighting this war. And through 9/11, which is the first lie, then you create the war on terrorism, which is the next lie. Then you create the war on Iraq for weapons of mass destruction, which is the next lie. And it's one lie to the next lie to the next lie. Now it's going to be Iran, the next lie, sending more troops and a surge into Iraq. It's just one thing leading to the other. It's always in the point of taking over more countries, more dominance, you know, making sure the American dollar, making sure the G8 stays in control of everything. And what they want to do is to control the American people, control the people of the world, put RFID chips in everybody, so everybody's a slave to these central banks.
So that's the voice of a US film producer, Aaron Russo, who got very friendly with a guy called Nick Rockefeller for a while. And Nick Rockefeller apparently told him about all these sorts of things, but then he decided he'd go public and blow the whistle about it. He was not happy at all. Aaron Russo's take on it, though, is, I think, something that many people understand now, Ian, which is that this whole war on terror was just an excuse for the US to go and do what, effectively, what Nazi Germany was doing, just invading whoever they wanted to.
Yeah, I think that's right. And the transparency of the lies, the simplistic, I think what strikes me often, and don't ask me for an example, you know, but what strikes me is that it's just so flagrant and so casual and so obviously not true if you're skeptical. It's a bit like they're saying, well, we don't care about you. You know, we're going to tell our loyal followers, the people who do well out of the system. There's still 30%, 40% who do quite well out of the system here in the UK. Might be less than that after the next recession. But, you know, really what they're doing is just a tribal call to arms, isn't it? With the lies as a sort of very thin, you know, reason to... They wouldn't really convince anybody neutral.
So anyway, we're going to hear now, finally on 9/11, from Scott Bennett. He's a former US psychological warfare officer. He was put in jail for speaking out about various things over in the US, and now he's writing about all these sorts of things. I mean, one of the most fascinating things that Scott revealed was that Al-Qaeda, the Free Syrian Army and ISIS, these kind of organizations, these mercenary groups, which were funded by foreigners in Syria trying to cause a Syrian civil war, proxy armies effectively were being funded through Swiss banks, and he was investigating that when he was working for the US authorities, and then he was put in jail. But anyway, Scott has some, I thought, quite interesting things to say when I spoke to him last week about the 9/11 being actually a precursor for what we're seeing now with this kind of COVID psychological warfare.
I don't think we would have had COVID-19 had we not had the psychological operation of September 11th. That September 11th should go down in history as the greatest crime against humanity ever committed. And it was committed by the United States, the CIA, the Mossad, the Saudis, the Israelis, the Bush administration, and Dick Cheney and Condoleezza Rice and General Dick Myers and Donald Rumsfeld and Dove Zakheim, who was my boss at Booz Allen Hamilton. All of these people should be charged for war crimes for the September 11th attacks. And you're exactly right. The physical scientific evidence is overwhelming that it was false. It was artificially designed, that Building 7 fell into its own footprint. I was personally at the Pentagon the next day. There was no plane anywhere. There was no wheels. There was no luggage. There was no massive engines. Nothing. It was just a big hole with a tarp covering it. And allegedly a missile had hit that. Now, every American who's worn the uniform since then should be charged with treason and executed if they do not stand on the side of the Constitution and come down on the right side of history that says this was a false flag attempt to manipulate America into war. You wear the uniform and swear an oath to the Constitution to protect it against all enemies, foreign and domestic, and that means we protect our country against lies and liars who position us, who feed us lies to position us for war. That's exactly what was done. The 7 countries in 5 years, the Odin Annan plan by Netanyahu. Netanyahu came to Congress and lied and said Iraq had weapons of mass destruction. You need to go to war. And that's precisely what happened. It all precipitated the 9/11 attacks. We've written a book on that. Robert David Steele and myself and other authors, and people can get it at shellgamewhistleblower.com. All of this precipitated the COVID-19 psyop. And the COVID-19 is conveniently happening just at the turn of another decade. So it's around the 10-year term when they pop one of these off, and this is the scary virus, the invisible, the death angel hovering over people's homes, so you better stay inside and wear your mask. I think it's trying to break down society. I think also it's created a certain level of animosity and anxiousness, and we see that in some of the Civil War disruptions and the protestations and the burning down of cities in America and elsewhere. But all of this was started in 2001, and we always have to come on the side of truth and separate ourselves from the lies. We have to come down on the side that, and I think Donald Trump is hopefully going to move in that direction, that endless wars and these things that have precipitated 9/11 are crimes, and they need to be exposed, and these wars need to be stopped. And the virus medical vaccine complex needs to be rejected entirely. And people need to really kind of wake up and do their own research. And I'm glad they have your show as one of the voices of truth, Tony, that they can tap into.
Well, I wouldn't necessarily. We're hopefully one of the voices of truth. It's very nice of him to say that, isn't it? But at the end of the day there, he's saying he's definitely not going to have any vaccines. But he sees this as almost like the dark forces, if we can call them that, seem to like to be able to define the decade at the beginning of the decade. He's linking the defining of the century, the 21st century, or 9/11, to something else going on now. But what do you make of what he had to say about 9/11?
I couldn't help noticing that phrase, against all enemies, because, of course, Richard Clarke's book was called Against All Enemies. So, you know, if there couldn't be better evidence that Richard Clarke is on the right side.
Scott Bennett also talked about, he thinks that the COVID psyop, as he calls it, has been a bit of a blunder.
They've grossly overstepped their bounds. This is a push towards fascism and a testing to see how people respond. Megan Whitmer of Michigan, shutting down football, shutting down churches, arresting people who go into congregations and these sort of things. The same thing being done in New Jersey by Murphy, the governor who shuts down a gym and throws the men in court and tries to imprison them for opening their gym. The attorney generals and the attorneys that prosecute hairdressers who have to work to feed their children, they're thrown in jail and go through the court system. This is what revolutions are made of. This is the substance of civil wars. This is the ignition for both revolutions and renaissance. And I think I would like to think that we're on the verge of a renaissance, because there are more intelligent people who value their freedom and their independence and have critical thinking and go, you know what? I have not been sick. My family hasn't been sick. If I did catch a flu, maybe I took propolis, oregano oil, vitamin C, and maybe hydroxychloroquine if it was serious, but I'm not losing my teeth or going blind or melting into a zombie. So this claim of otherwise is all propaganda.
That's the former psychological warfare officer for the U.S. Army, Scott Bennett there. The interesting angle he's got, Martin, here, I think, on this case, is that they may have just pushed this one too far. And actually, what may come out of this is some kind of renaissance, something positive, as people kick back against the lies.
Well, I think we've got to distinguish between COVID and 9/11. We were talking about 9/11.
He's talking about COVID.
No, he's coming and talking about COVID. So we're coming back to talk about COVID. Let's come back to my views on COVID. I think it's a biological warfare attack on the Chinese Communist Party, which has been allowed to flow back over the United States of America to cover up the second bailout. You mentioned 2001 there and the decade. The other thing that's happened in 2008, the banking system collapsed. And at that point, capitalism...
But we're getting away from the point here. What about this idea that maybe they pushed it too far?
Well, they've pushed it too far because the Chinese jumped on the biological warfare attack, and they've had a tenth of the deaths that we've had in this country. And because they treated it as a biological warfare attack, they've managed to keep it out. And all of their ships and planes, for example, are COVID-free. As they go to war in the South China Sea, they're going to find it's quite good.
I've got a little bit of personal anecdote here. Because a few weeks ago, they started saying, oh, well, this is the Chinese flu, you know, let's blame the Chinese for that. And at that point, I was contacted again by our wonderful friends in the mainstream media from the Times. I got this rather nasty email that popped into my interest saying, I'm planning to write about you in the Sunday Times. I believe you've been undermining morale in the fight against COVID. That was because of my statements on TV that I didn't think it was serious.
Which journalist was that?
I'm not going to dignify him with a name.
Oh, that's a shame. But we can know to put him on our block list.
Yeah.
But
what had upset them was this issue about how it started. And I'd said on an alternative radio show, Kevin Barrett's show, that if the CIA were going to start accusing the Chinese of creating this, then it was probably more plausible that, as Martin says, I'm not saying this is plausible, but it would be more plausible, that if anything, the CIA planted it on China. And that really upset the Sunday Times. They went to the trouble of, hounding me and trying to get me to rescind what I was saying.
The Sunday Times, of course, is owned by Rupert Murdoch. And, of course, the Murdoch press in Australia went big on this. They said they got inside information that, in fact, it was leaked from the Wuhan laboratory. Steve Bannon, who's now under arrest for something else, said, and we've got an insider who will tell us that the Chinese deliberately did this, this, and this. So they came out with the thing that this is a biological warfare attack by China. But, of course, why would China do it on themselves?
Yes.
And, of course, they wouldn't. Mm. But, of course, I'm quite sure the Chinese intelligence services are thinking about exactly the same
thing. So why is Murdoch weighed in so hard on this, then, do you think?
Well, because Murdoch was one of the owners of... Do you remember the World Trade Center was privatised some weeks before the attack? And it was Larry Silverstein who bought it. And Murdoch is a... is in business with Silverstein.
I think he's in it, an oil firm over.
That's
in,
right, and the
Levant.
Yeah, in the Golan Heights, there's the Genie Oil, which is going. There's a load of oil in the Golan.
So they're
Heights.
Mates, basically.
Yeah, I mean Murdoch is
business friends.
If we're looking as police officers or revenging terrorists, the list of people who are involved, it's Silverstein. Yeah, because he was the one who made the decision to blow WTC7. Yeah, and of course they made a massive fortune on the insurance.
So we're doing quite a lot of joining.
Anybody in the elite has got, because like I was saying earlier about
Giuliani,
basic human psychology. Anybody in America in the elite knows instinctively the truth, which is that if you can blame a foreign enemy, it takes the heat off you.
I think we've done quite a good job there in opening up a little bit of a few clues about the international mafia and the real criminals behind 9/11. But look, one of the things I really like to, before we have our final item, which is about the Rosicrucians, this week there's been a quite extraordinary video being put out by Elon Musk. And Elon Musk is one of those Bilderberg characters who's very much into the whole idea of transhumanism, the idea that human beings are here to genetically modify themselves to become actually whatever they wish to be. They're also rather into the idea that, if you pay enough money, you should be able to have a child that lives forever.
Mm.
All these kinds of things, like, for example, hooking into from the digital world of computers straight into the human brain. Well, anyway, Elon Musk is revealing this week his latest moves to do this.
Can I just mention one thing before we move away from 9/11? There's a leafleting outside the BBC on the anniversary, the 19-year anniversary, which falls at the end of this week.
Okay, so where is the BBC
week?
In London? Shepherd's
Bush? Portland Place.
Oh, right. So
yeah,
the
main
BBC radio.
Okay.
The radio place just by Oxford Circus.
Oxford Circus, yeah.
Okay,
and it's
thanks.
There on Reinvestigate
9/11
website. 3 o'clock in the afternoon.
Okay, so
and we're going to be there for about 3 hours.
Would like to go and meet Ian?
Yeah, I'll be there.
Do you go to the pub afterwards or anything like that?
We used to. I'm not quite sure what we're going to do this time.
I think you should, if you're allowed to.
No, not if there's more than 50 people.
Maybe we'll crack open a few cans of
I think if you've got more than 50 people, you need to go to two pubs at least anyway. Anyway, so let's have a listen to this thing about the Neuralink from Elon Musk this week, which is a pretty extraordinary idea. What he wants to do is saw a little hole in your brain, put a kind of coin-shaped thing in your brain, use a bit of superglue to stick it there, using a robot. So he wants to be able to sort of plug, basically, a kind of Wi-Fi thing straight into your brain. Elon Musk, take it away.
Going into the Neuralink architecture, what we've done over the past year is dramatically simplify the device. So we about a year ago, we had a device which had multiple parts, including a piece that it had to sort of sit behind your ear, and it was complex, and you wouldn't still look totally normal. You'd have a thing behind your ear. So we've simplified this to simply something that is about the size of a large coin, and it goes in your skull, replaces a piece of skull, and the wires then connect within a few centimeters or about an inch away from the device. And this is sort of what it looks like. Yeah. This is that little device. That thing at the bottom is just to hold the threads in place because they're just like little fine wires. I mean, frankly, to sort of simplify this, it's more complicated than this, but it's in a lot of ways, it's kind of like a Fitbit in your skull with tiny wires. And it's, so our current prototype, version 0.9, has about 1,000 channels. So that's about 100 times better than the next best consumer device that's available. And it's a 23 millimeters by 8 millimeters. It actually fits quite nicely in your skull because your skull is about 10 millimeters thick. So it fits, it goes flush with your skull, it's invisible, and all you can see afterwards is this tiny scar. And if it's under your hair, you can't see it at all. In fact, I could have a Neuralink right now, and you wouldn't know. Maybe I do. In terms of getting a link, so that, you need to have the device, a great device, and you also need to have a great robot that puts in the electrodes and does the surgery. So you want the surgery to be as automated and as possible, and the only way you can achieve the level of precision that's needed is with an advanced robot. So we're really looking for great people who can help develop both the device and the robot. And we feel confident about getting the link procedure, the installation of a link, done in under an hour. So you can basically go in the morning and leave the hospital in the afternoon. And it can be done without general anesthesia. So in terms of getting a link, like I said, it's essentially you open a piece of skull, you remove about a coin-sized piece of skull, and then the robot inserts the electrodes. We'll talk more about that later. Then the device replaces the portion of skull that was removed, and we basically close that up with actually super glue, which is how a lot of wounds are closed, and then you can just walk around right afterwards. It's pretty cool.
So that's Elon Musk this week talking about his wonderful thing called the Neuralink. Well, the Neuralink, Martin was asking while we were listening to that, well, what's the point of this thing? So, Martin, the answer is, you'd have to ask Elon Musk, but what he's saying is that this will allow you to have a direct communication with a computer. So you will be able to think your way into the computer, and the computer will be able to think its way into your brain. The idea is linking up neurons in your brain with digital information. He's talking there about hundreds of little tiny wires from the bottom side of this coin-shaped thing that's going to go apparently into your skull, then linking up with a through Wi-Fi of some sort and through this device into a computer. This is one of the dreams of the transhumanists, actually, which is the idea of a human brain nervous system digital interface. This is what he's producing.
Yeah, well, I mean, Elon Musk the other day tweeted after the coup in Bolivia, somebody was saying that this is a coup, removing Morales. He said, we'll coup who we want to. That was his exact words. And, of course, he was behind the coup in Bolivia because Bolivia's got very big supplies of lithium.
Ken Livingstone's actually just written an article.
Lithium is very important.
The lithium coup.
Yes, a lithium coup. And, of course, Elon Musk was a major player in that. And there you go.
Speaking as an old science fiction fan, I think it's a great pity that, you know, science fiction has fallen down the memory hole to quite a large extent. Ian Banks is a great writer, if anybody's out there wants to read any.
Fantastic stuff.
And, you know, but that's where it should stay, you know.
These are dystopias they're writing about.
Yeah.
You know, this is the fact of the matter. It's almost like he's trying to sell this. This is a great marketing thing. Hey, this is going to be wonderful. Actually, the world he's describing here is definitely a dystopia.
He's another Richard Branson, isn't he, whose top skill is self-publicity.
Martin, would you like to?
Are you going to have one of these things? Well, I mean, no. I mean, I've just been reading Yuval, I think his name is, who's written these books about Homo sapiens and the Homo futura. I can't remember the name of it now, but they're very popular and lots of people have read them. And he sees the dangers of AI coming forward, and also genetic engineering. And that, you know, they're trying to create superhumans. The elite are fantasizing about the idea that they can have super babies and things of this sort. And, that this is now becoming a feasible fantasy for them to pursue. And, of course, that doesn't, you know, they're not trying to solve problems that we need to solve. They're solving problems that they want to solve for their own purposes.
Yeah, it's a bit like the colony on Mars crowd, isn't it?
Yes, exactly. I mean, we can't feed people and we can't keep the bogs open in Bristol because we haven't got any money, but we're all going to be super chess players once we put this stuff in our brains, you know.
William Gibson is one of the authors I remember reading years ago who was talking about all this sort of thing, cyberpunk. But yeah. It was always, look, the people trying to do this are the bad guys. So he almost seems a bit shameless, Elon Musk.
Yeah. I think there's just, you know, some people are just a little bit deranged, and they can, you know, if they've got a good business head at the same time, then they can get
you old Luddite, you. Anyway. So we're going to wrap up tonight with a listen to David Livingstone, who just coincidentally is the author of this book, Transhumanism, The History of a Dangerous Idea. But here he is talking about another book that he wrote several years ago called The Dying God, about a medieval satanic group. What he says effectively is that they built the British Empire. A militant atheist establishment was created here in Britain, which led on to what we would call the New World Order of today. The New World, of course, being the United States.
The key central crucible, the key event that gives rise to the Rosicrucian movement, which is an alchemical hermetic movement. So this marriage, their marriage of King James's daughter and Frederick V, is called an alchemical wedding.
Hmm.
And what happens is that their grandchildren then become kings. I mean, what happens in between is that King James basically succeeds Elizabeth I, and she runs an occult ring, which is headed by John Dee, the sorcerer. John Dee and Francis Bacon are the two sources of the Rosicrucian teachings. She is succeeded by King James. King James is succeeded by Charles I. Charles I is executed by Oliver Cromwell, who basically succeeds to power for a short period. Cromwell was surrounded by Rosicrucian. His movement was a Rosicrucian movement. And they were in contact with the chief rabbi of Amsterdam. His name was Manasseh ben Israel. So all the leading Rosicrucians were in the circle of Manasseh ben Israel, and they were working together to petition Cromwell to allow the return of the Jews to England. Because the Jews, like in many countries of the world, had been forbidden access from England. They succeed. Oliver Cromwell allows the return of the Jews. So what happens is that the followers of Manasseh ben Israel in London, they establish the first synagogue in London called the Bevis Marks Synagogue. Hmm. And they become involved with the Rosicrucians. The Rosicrucians are also called the Invisible College. So the Invisible College developed the Royal Society.
Oh, the Royal Society of Science?
Right.
Oh, okay, All right.
So that's where we get all the people like Newton, of course.
Right.
Newton
right, yeah.
was heavily interested in Rosicrucianism. So out of those circles, the Royal Society basically developed Freemasonry.
Talking about Freemasonry being developed by the Royal Society. Now, Martin, I know this isn't really your thing, is it? It's not the official version of history at all. But, I mean, he's a Muslim scholar. He's got a right to his point of view, hasn't he?
Yeah, and I've got the right to say that could be construed as an anti-Semitic conspiracy theory.
Would you throw him out of the party?
Unfortunately, that's not an issue we have to deal with.
What do you make of these sorts of views of history? And it's a very, very, it's not what we're taught in school at all, is it?
Well, the first thing that comes to mind, I'm afraid I'm, you know, a bit sceptical, Tony. The first thing that comes to mind is that he's basically writing off, you know, some of the best scientists in the history of the human race, you know, as being pawns of something. Maybe they just thought it was unfair on the Jews that they weren't allowed to live here.
Well, I mean, one of his arguments is that even though people use the expression Jews, Christian, even Muslims, he's critical of the Muslims as well. He's saying there's actually occult organizations that are using these as fronts.
Yeah,
that's different. That's a different issue. That's, you know, but quite likely, you know, obviously you do get, to use a word we've touched on earlier, conspiracies to infiltrate things, you know, but you can't necessarily blame the body that houses these conspiracies because it may not be aware of them. And most conspiracies aren't very successful anyway, I don't suppose.
Okay, can you just wind up by reminding us about your little gig this week on the BBC? At the BBC, outside the BBC, Broadcasting House.
Friday the 11th of September, 3 o'clock or 4 o'clock. We're going to be there for a few hours. We've got some leaflets to give away. The BBC take them. You know, we got rid of loads. We ran out of leaflets last year. Although I wrote them myself, I'd like to say that they're good and unbiased.
Well, maybe they take them in as exchange for a free cup of coffee at the bar, and then they take them away and shred them in the
Well, the news department are the only snotty ones, and I do recognise a few faces that you see on TV, and they were quite hostile, but everybody else. Because most people who work at that building are actually perfectly ordinary people. They're not sort of, you know, MI5 linked propagandists, which unfortunately some of the people on the news department are.
So I think we should be cheering for the sacking of all of the senior managers at the BBC, including the new Director General, who, by the way, is a graduate of where? Anywhere interesting? No, PepsiCo. So the idea is we're going to have a massive, great Pepsi advert now.
Oh,
so they're going to be the BBC.
And Pepsi's the worse than Coke. Pepsi's the Republican one. Coke's the Democratic one.
God help! I'm glad you've cleared that one up.
God help the BBC under this new Director General. Anyway, time to sign off now. Thanks for our guest to our guest in the first hour. This author of 9/11 Revealed, Ian Henshaw, also to Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. Thanks also to our sturdy studio engineer Dave Bazanko. Download our MP3s and you can listen in the car anywhere you like. You'll find this show's podcast, story links, comment page and our contact details and the contact details of BCFM manager and board at thisweekoneword.org.uk. I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Have a relaxing and enjoyable BCFM weekend, Sunday evening, 6 p.m, Danny Lopsch and the Contemporary Christian Music Show. Fantastic listen. Do please join us for the Politics Show live stream at 5 o'clock next Friday. God bless. And don't let the banksters get you down.